Welcome to your own health and fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss the personal politics of health. Why are some people more capable of loving than others? Is it possible to will yourself to be the right kind of person? Does man, the only animal that kills its own, have a greater capacity for loving than other mammals? As research reveals the working of the brain, it might be uncovering the origins of love and empathy. Join me in the next hour as we find out what three scientist clinicians in the field of psychiatry think about the nature of loving. My guest is Dr. Thomas Lewis, co-author of the new book, A General Theory of Love. Dr. Thomas Lewis is an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine and a former associate director of the Affective Disorders Program there. Dr. Lewis currently divides his time between writing, private practice, and teaching at the UCSF Medical School. He lives in Sausalito, California, and he is here in person. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
The co-authors are Dr. Fariami, MD, and Richard Lamon, who are also psychiatrists and researchers at UCSF. What process sort of happened between the three of you that birthed this book?
Well, it was an interesting process that evolved over a number of years. Dr. Amini, who's the most senior in our group, had been interested in the psychology and biology of emotion for many years, although he was trained as a psychoanalyst. Dr. Lannan was actually a student of his at UCSF, and the two of them kind of fell in together and started teaching a seminar on the relationship between psychology and biology. When I was a student, I wound up taking that seminar and became kind of engrossed in it and stayed on and taught it with them. And the three of us started meeting on the weekends to talk about psychology and biology and emotions. And at the end of several years of talking, we found out that we had something to say about how love and emotions are configured. And that's really where the book came from.
You've given reptiles a very bad rap in this book. As you've attempted to explain why our brains are constructed to enable us to recognize and connect with other animals, do you want to explain what it is that I mean? I have to be honest with you, I think, although I enjoyed the book a lot, I found that part of it a little black and white. It's hard for me to imagine that it's true that reptiles have absolutely no emotional content whatsoever. I mean, people have pets.
Well, although people had pet rocks for a while, too, and they were very popular.
We're going to get phone calls on this.
The part of the book that you're referring to, if you look at the part of the brain where emotions come from and where attachment and bonding and affiliation come from, they come from a part of the brain that evolved when mammals split off from the reptiles. And it is very hard for mammals such as ourselves to imagine what it's like to have a brain that is not emotional. To imagine what it's like not to feel things like loyalty or affection, or not to have any concept of kind of a friendliness toward another creature because it's one of our own. But as far as anyone can make out, reptiles don't experience those motivations whatsoever. They are, in a real sense, animated eating machines, and they eat and they breed. And that's about it.
Why do you know that that's so? Why do you believe that that's so?
Well, for instance, say if you take a baby mammal away from its parents, the baby and the parents both enter into a characteristic kind of behavior pattern. There's a lot of vocalization. There's a lot of distress. Physiologic changes occur in terms of heart rate and blood pressure, and changes occur in the brain. All of those changes are orchestrated by that particular part of the brain that postdates the reptiles. If you take a baby reptile away from its parents, nothing happens, actually. There is no reaction on the part of either one of them. It's things like that make you realize that that reptiles don't experience what are some of the most fundamental motivations in our minds, and that a reptilian way of life is really very different from a mammalian way of life.
And what you're really talking about here is the fact that we have sort of three brains that are stacked on top of each other, the reptilian one being the oldest and most, as you say, it's the one that when someone's hooked up to a machine and they're theoretically sort of almost brain dead or there's not any activity in the neocortex, the reptilian brain keeps the breath going and the, you know, So that sort of thing. So why don't you go ahead and explain the other two brains and what it is that makes us unique as mammals and even more so as human beings.
Well, as the vertebrates emerged from the sea and fish, you know, started to walk on the land and became lizards and snakes and reptiles, the brain that they have is very, very old, and it's oriented towards survival, and it has a number of survival reflexes, and it's not oriented toward learning very much. When mammals split off from the reptilian line, mammals have a different style of rearing young. That reptiles give birth to eggs, and then they don't rear them. They simply plop out an egg and then leave.
In fact, they sometimes eat them.
Sometimes they do, yeah. Mm. Mammals give birth to helpless infants that have to be cared for. They have to be fed and kept warm and given water. They have to be nurtured. They have to be protected from predators for an extended period of time. And so the mammalian brain has to have all the neural equipment to do those things, to care about something else because it's related to you, to care about little helpless things, and to feel affection and loyalty and nurturance and bonding.
Where does that happen?
That all happens in the limbic part of the brain, mm-hmm. Which sits just atop the reptilian part and evolved after it. And that's the part of the brain that gives us our experience of love and our motivations inside of love. Then about 2 million years ago, in the primate line of mammals, a certain part of the brain started to grow very rapidly, and that's actually the part that constitutes most of the brain volume in our skulls, and that's the neocortex, which is important in kind of advanced cognitive processing, the kinds of things that are necessary for hypothetical reasoning or logic or abstraction, the mm-hmm. kind of things that make mathematics or physics or language, spoken mm-hmm. or written language, possible. And that's one of the things that makes us unique in the animal kingdom, is that we have this enormous neocortex and we have the cognitive capacities that it gives us. However, crouching underneath all the time is still that same mammalian brain that's equipping us with much older motivations pertaining to nurturance and love.
You make a case, this is, again, we're talking about a general theory of love, which is a new book that's been published recently. It's Vintage is the publisher, make a case, a scientific case, for this being an evolutionary advantage. This might not be the way most people feel about it. I mean, the presence of a capacity to empathize with other people's pain, the distraction of attachment, the longings, and all that, how does that make us better candidates for survival?
Well, the reason really dates back to the origin of mammals. In order for something to be successful for a species, it doesn't have to be successful for each and every member of the species in every situation. It just has to be, in general, more successful than not. The mammalian style of rearing infants clearly is not the only one. I mean, there's many different ways of giving birth and having offspring that don't involve the mammalian style. So it's not the only one. It's not the exclusive one or the best one. But once you give birth to a helpless, immature infant, if you are not motivated to care for it and communicate with it and protect it, your offspring are not going to survive and your genes are not going to wind up in the next generation. And so really what we see is that our brains are the result of the animals who lived and had successful child-rearing experiences, and the way they did that was through empathy and nurturance and communication.
Yeah, although the irony of modern life is that now anybody, you know, can have a child survive even if they're not equipped, whether we call it strictly just, you know, the tissue capacity in the cortex or what we want to say about that, but they don't have this, and we'll talk about what goes wrong and how what sorts of things can mess with that. Well, and in fact, you know, maybe this is even a way to enter into it. One of the things that's very interesting about observing humans as animals and their behavior patterns, and even primates to some extent, is what it is, the question of what enables one individual to sustain terrible abuse in their young infancy and childhood and have terrible hardships, and another individual the same, and you take these two individuals, one of them survives very well and becomes very strong and sort of indomitable, and the other one is crushed by it and becomes an unfeeling person or even a pathological person. What are the things that you think are going to factor into that, whether one person does well or another does poorly?
Well, there are two factors. One is genetic constitution or temperament. And it's clear that some parts of the brain are built according to a genetic scaffold or a genetic plan or blueprint, and that you can have a brain, you can inherit a brain design that's pretty resilient, and you can inherit brain designs that are much less resilient.
Yeah, but you see, in the same family, you'll see two individuals who are starkly different.
Well, that's although two individuals in the same family share a lot of genes, but they're not genetically identical.
Yeah, that's true.
That's one influence. The other influence that you often see in the disparate cases that you're mentioning is that is the influence of relatedness or attachment to mold the brain. Often children, even who come from families of severe abuse, manage to find somebody in their sphere of influence that is a positive effect, whether it's a grandparent or an extended family member or a teacher or a mentor or a music teacher or a neighbor's parent, somebody in their sphere of influence that gives them some nurturing and some emotional strength.
You seem to weigh in kind of equally toward believing that genes are important, but that nurturance is terribly important, that there's no substitute for early learning that changes the brain and the chemistry of the brain. What I didn't notice in the book, which surprised me, is the fact that you've got an infant floating around in his or her mother's chemistry. Mm-hmm. During pregnancy, and when women are under stress or have been abused or have terrible, not even to say their diet and whether or not they're drinking and smoking, but even if it's just a question of stress, the baby is swimming in those neurotransmitters. And many people feel now that genes are much less of an influence than previous. I mean, the more we start unpacking genes, the more we see that we're more similar to simpler things that we thought, animals we thought were more simpler. So the effect of the mother's chemistry seems lacking in this book to me a bit.
It's true that we didn't go into that, and it's true it's a fascinating subject area. And actually, there's good evidence, as you mentioned, that women who are under a significant amount of emotional stress during their pregnancy give birth to babies who have some developmental problems. And the suspicion is that that influence is mediated by neurohormonal modulators in the mother's bloodstream that cross the placenta and interact with the developing fetal brain. So it's becoming more and more apparent that that is the case, that emotional stress during pregnancy really can alter fetal brain structure and function.
Well, and in fact, you even talk about the fact that a baby inside the mother's womb will learn the mother's language, the mother's native tongue, will come out with a capacity for learning that language. So if that's the case, certainly, you know, if they're sharing a blood supply, they're sharing pharmacology. You know?
They certainly are. Yeah. It's a very intimate tie.
You're listening to an interview with Dr. Thomas Lewis, who is a psychiatrist and professor at UCSF. He is co-author of the book A General Theory of Love, although he has, for the most part, penned this book. And the reason I wanted him here in the studio live is because the book is very well written and it's surprisingly lyrical. It's very scientific. It's this odd combination of being almost coldly scientific and very sort of lyrical at odd times. Very interesting book to read. You talk about, you know, you're sort of giving, you've taken research, you've broken down, you've gone through all the research, you've got all your references in the back, and you discuss research of why we know that mammals function the way they do in certain situations, and the breakdown of the three brains, and you talk about the limbic region being the place where we protect our young and therefore resonate and connect. And you use a term called limbic resonance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you make a good case for it. I think that there's a section where you talk about when you look into somebody's eyes, essentially what's happening is you're resonating with them on a deeper level. There's an unspoken, there's a communication. And then in some cases that's breached and just hurt or damaged in some people, and they don't have that. Why don't we talk a bit about, I'm rather inclined to talk about love, mm-hmm. since the book is about love, although I must say that there's an awful lot of science in this book. It's not just about love. It's about the human brain and the structure of it and the biochemistry of it. And so it's very interesting because it makes a very strong case for whether or not we can change once we've developed a certain way. Why don't we talk about what we have to endure to love? I mean, love, essentially, from what you're saying in the book, changes us profoundly in a physiologic way.
It certainly does. And in fact, as we discuss in the book, there's quite a lot of evidence now to support something which people, or at least many people, especially in times past, have known kind of intuitively, which is that relationships are necessary for human survival, that really the human organism is constructed such that that relationships or emotional contact are a physiologic need on par with things like water or oxygen or food, and that if you take them away, bad things happen to the body and brain fairly shortly. One of the things that often surprises people is to find out that infants who are given food and water and shelter and clothing but are denied emotional contact, almost all of them die, which is a fairly stark illustration of how vital emotional contact is in human life right from the start. And it's true that emotional contact and relationships shape the brain. The brain is the most plastic or the most moldable in childhood, but it continues to be plastic and malleable throughout the lifespan, and our relationships are changing us every day as we're in them. And if they're good, healthy relationships, then we're benefiting from that and we're gaining physiologic strength and resilience. And if they are negative, they're taking a toll on us. And even if we're not having any relationships, that also has an effect on the brain.
Well, there's a double-edged sword here, because a good relationship is one where you become addicted, even on a physical level. To the extent of your internal pharmacology, you become addicted to the other person. And you get a tremendous amount from the other person, but you talk a lot about what happens to anyone, not just someone who would be termed neurotic, someone who had a particularly toxic, as people like to say, childhood, somebody who had maybe a reasonable, if such a thing is possible in this modern culture, childhood. Still, when they're deprived of the object of their affection, even if it's a close friendship, suffer just terribly. So why shouldn't we just avoid it and become self-contained? I mean, in our modern culture, you see increasingly people who choose to be single all their lives. In particular, I know that women often feel, there are many books written, not many, there are several books written about how much better women do when they're alone, you know, when they finally just go off on their own, they're doing their own. I will say that I'm asking you this question, but I'm also saying that I think that people underestimate how much their friendships, how important their friendships and their animals and things like that are. But why don't you go ahead and comment on what I'm saying? What's wrong with just becoming a strong, independent person?
What's wrong is that it's a cultural myth rather than a realizable fact that it's true that we live in an odd culture in which an ideal is held up that if people achieve kind of the highest level of maturity, they would be self-sufficient. They wouldn't need anybody. They could just do whatever they wanted, and their happiness would come from within. And you hear people say that a lot. Unfortunately, there's no truth to it whatsoever, that if people are operating at their highest level, they continue to get a vital and irreplaceable source of sustenance, both emotional and physical, from the relationships around them. Just like they get sustenance from food and water. And it's every bit as crazy to say, well, I'll just give up food and water because I'm an emotionally mature person and I don't need that, as it would be to say, well, I'll just give up relationships and become self-sufficient. It's an odd cultural fantasy, but it can't be realized.
I think that one of the things that is sad about this ideal that's being held up in our modern culture is that it gives people the illusion that highly successful people do it all on their own, that they've done it by themselves. And, you know, there are many different types of relationships. All of them are emotional because of what you call the limbic resonance because of the fact that we communicate through this resonance and that it's not all, you know, it's one of those things where someone tells you what they thought that you said and you go, oh my God, that's not what I said. So you realize so much of it's happening on a nonverbal level. So much of it is, as you discuss, how we read each other physically, how we read our facial expressions and things.
That's, you know, that's very true. And I just want to underscore your point about how the culture misleads us about what successful people are like, because it's true that we see them in magazines and on television, and they look pretty good. And I probably wouldn't have believed it, actually, unless I were a psychiatrist and I had met a number of extremely successful people who had, you know, wealth and power and material possessions and career success far in excess of anything that I'll ever achieve, I think, and they are simultaneously completely miserable, utterly unhappy, don't know a moment's peace during the day. I was very surprised to find that out.
Well, that's true, but they also almost inevitably have people around them. People are not successful alone. They're not successful in a vacuum. They're either good schmoozers, they're good at making connections, and that's their emotional thing. That's how they get their emotional yayas, is by connecting on that level. Or what we mostly see is that people really do have strong ties to other people. No successful person that I'm aware of, I mean, I'm sure there are going to be exceptions, but that I'm aware of, they all seem to have people in place helping them along the way. Nobody does it completely alone. So this brings up an interesting problem, because we have in psychotherapy now a movement toward, has been for, God, at least 15 years or more, a movement toward people, and I think it's valuable, learning to self-nurture themselves. Because if you, in fact, sort of become very passive and you expect or need or demand constantly to have an immature relationship with adults in the present, where you're expecting them to meet needs from childhood that you didn't feel were completed, that it's, you find yourself, as you say, repeating and repeating and repeating these terrible patterns, and we'll talk about what that's called and stuff. But one of the tactics, one of the ways to work on this, is to begin to develop an inner advisor that's a mature part of your brain to sort of help. A mature part of your psyche, your brain, isn't, you know, to talk to you and sort of help you through these parts, this inner child sort of stuff. So what's your comment about that? I mean, is there a double edge to that as well?
Well, there's a limit actually to it. I think it's very true that children in good relationships with parents and adults come to internalize in their brain some of the good regulatory parental functions, whether it's praising them or acknowledging their specialness or nurturing them in different ways. And then people become, after exposure to that, people become capable of doing some of those same things for themselves. And
No, I'm talking actually about people who did not get that in childhood, who then as adults in therapy, you know what I mean, right?
Yeah, it was possible to get it later if you didn't get it in childhood.
So to learn to do that. Mm-hmm.
But still, the expectation shouldn't be that at the end of the psychological road of happiness that you would be completely self-nurturing and doing it all by yourself, because that's not the case, actually. Probably the end of the road is that you would do for yourself what you could, and what you couldn't do, you would allow someone else to do for you, and you would do for them. And that
that's
really
a good way
of
putting it.
Yeah.
So what we're really talking about is how childhood experiences form what you call very distinct forms of memory. You talk about implicit and explicit memories. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about splitting it up that way is it helps us to understand, it's a way for us to get a grasp on the way in which we get caught in habituated behaviors without having any idea that we're doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, the person who takes terrible jobs over and over again and says, but, you know, they really are certifiable. They're horrible people. And, you know, sooner or later somebody says, yes, but why did you not know to protect yourself again? Mm-hmm. So how does that work? What is implicit, explicit for you in terms of memory?
The explicit memory is the kind of memory that allows you to learn facts and pieces of data that someone tells you or presents to you or that you experience. So that you could learn what the tallest mountain in the world is, or what you could remember what you had for breakfast yesterday, that kind of point.
You can.
I can. Yeah. Not every day. Fact-based learning. And that's carried out by the neocortex, that last advanced brain, and it does it very well and very rapidly. the emotional parts of the brain or the limbic brain don't use that method of learning. They actually predate it. The method of learning that they use is this implicit memory, which is a slow, gradual accretion of intuition, really, that comes from exposure to repeated instances of something. For instance, it's the same kind of learning that people use when they learn language. The very fact that I'm speaking must mean that I know thousands of rules of grammar about subject and verb and participle and tense and many rules of phonology, but I'm not aware of any of that. I can just speak, and it comes very naturally because my implicit memory is handling all of those rules for me, and I don't have to think about it. And you're quite right that what you see in relationship life is that people go out in the world and they have learned kind of an emotional language or a relationship language, and they enact it in an unconscious way. They don't realize that they're doing it. They don't realize that they've learned anything at all. And they engage in the same repetitive relationship behaviors, whether they're rewarding or not, and oftentimes they aren't rewarding.
We're going to need to break shortly, but one of the other things that you explain that I think is a good base for understanding how we get caught up in learning the things that we've learned that we don't even realize we're operating from is this concept of limbic attractors, how they mold our personalities.
The concept of the attractor is a fascinating one, and it's also a bit elusive for many people. But what it amounts to is that if you learn something very well, your brain stores kind of a concentrated prototype of it, or the essence of it. And it strongly motivates you to see that particular thing when you encounter things that are somewhat like it. For instance, this is how people can read written handwriting, where the shapes of the letters really differ quite markedly from what an H should look like or an A should look like. But the reason people can do it is that they have a very strong essence stored in their brain for what H's could look like, and that actually molds their experience of all the various dissimilar stimuli so that it looks like an H and they can read.
We're going to have to take a brief break. I think what we're talking about here is how we fill in the blanks and how we learn to do that. We're going to need to take a very short 30-second break. I'm speaking with Dr. Thomas Lewis, co-author of A General Theory of Love. I'm Lena Berman. We're going to break for a second. Stay with us.
When I look in, deepness of the sea, I see the deepness of the love, the love I feel you feel for me. Autumn comes, summer dies, I see the passing of the years in your eyes, and when we part there'll be no tears, no goodbyes, I'll just look into your eyes.
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm live in the studio with Dr. Thomas Lewis, researcher, professor, psychiatrist. I want to make sure I don't make too much of a mistake. There is a big difference because he is a physician. Dr. Thomas Lewis, co-author of A General Theory of Love, and we're talking about the science of love, if you can talk about such a thing.
As you can. Actually,
yes, clearly you can. Clearly you can. Okay, so we were talking about the things that the way we learn and the way that the learning forms us and changes us in ways that are so subtle that we're not aware that we're acting out of that learning.
Yeah, and I think you put it very well when you said that it's the way that the brain fills in the blanks. And it really does, to an extent that's far greater than any of us realize, that we start to see a little bit of a perceptual stimulus and the brain rushes in and fills it in. And what we experience appears very straightforward to us on the experiencing end, and it's actually not. It's actually the end result of a lot of sophisticated processing and filling in, some of which is erroneous. So the reality that we go through our daily lives experiencing is not actually reality. And for some people, the distinction between reality and what they experience can be very significant and very problematic.
Well, and one of the ways that we see this is in people who feel out of control in their lives, like the person the made-up person we had, who continually takes jobs that seem there's a lack of capacity for self-protection. You know, you go right back into situations that are apparently familiar, but you're not even aware that you're doing it. You think you asked all the right questions, you take a terrible job again. Or people who are depressed or violent. And depression is very interesting because depression is the most obvious place where we see people whose reality is so altered. No matter what you say to a depressed person, they can't, they're profoundly altered in their worldview. And there's no talking them out of it. It's the only thing is that there has to be something that moves them on, almost physically or physiologically or something. But
that's very true. And if you see someone who's very depressed, their worldview is very off. And one of the interesting things is if you see people who are a little bit less depressed, their worldview is a little less off. And then eventually you see people who are just a little off in some way, which may be anxious or it may be nostalgic or it may be in another emotional direction, and then you realize that person is not too different from me, that I may go through the world, and the feeling that I start out with in the morning will influence what I experience in the morning. And if I'm feeling pessimistic, I'll miss opportunities. If I'm feeling wistful, I'll spend the morning, things will remind me of my past. And that to a much greater extent than any of us realize, we're carried along by what's going on in our brains, and our lives are shaped by what's already going in there emotionally.
I guess it would be foolish to ask when to be concerned, but I guess if you find yourself, I think the reason I say that, the reason it isn't obviously the case, is that people who are depressed make a really good case for their state.
Oh, they
because
do.
Because it's totally real for them.
And so do people who are highly anxious or people who are paranoid. Mm-hmm. If you spend time talking to them, that's one of the legacies of the cortical brain, is that whatever you feel, you can always explain it in words, but that's so much window dressing. It's a lot of hand waving. It has nothing to do with the actual cause of why it is you feel that.
Well, and you bring up a very important point then, because you make a very important point in this book. It was one I had to wait a long time to get to. I knew you were headed in that direction, which is that therapy is physiologic. It isn't just something that changes your brain in terms of thinking. It isn't separate. You, in fact, make a great case for the inseparability, if such a word exists, of the body and the mind, that this is not, you find neurons all over the body. They're in the gut. You know, they're everywhere. But if that's the case, and you're a psychiatrist, that means that you're either going to give somebody a drug, because you guys are famous for, or you're going to talk to them. And this brings up a very interesting problem, because if you talk to somebody, so what happens is that you begin to talk about the fact that therapy can't only function, the therapist is not going to be sitting there as neutrally as they appear to be sitting there. What is a therapist doing?
That's a great question. And, of course, there's a lot of argument and contention about what the therapist is really doing. What we would say the therapist is not doing is delivering that kind of thinking or cognitive information to somebody.
You hope.
Because you can see people all the time who are very cognitively skilled, but it doesn't change how they feel or what they do in the slightest bit. And what we would say the therapist is doing is detecting when that person is a little bit off emotionally and then going to them emotionally and saying, you're a little off. Why don't you move this way or come with me this way? Or say in a relationship that the person does something which is problematic, either with you or describing doing it with somebody else. And in an emotional connection, you can say to them whatever your words are. You can say to them, that's not the way to do it. Do it more like this. I know how to do it.
Yeah, but if you say that to somebody, they're going to say, don't tell me what to do. I mean, you can't really say to somebody, you're not doing it right.
Sure you can.
Well,
I mean, it depends. Different people will be...
This works for you?
Sure it does. Because the people know they're not doing it right, or they wouldn't be sitting in the office.
All right, so you're talking about in a therapeutic situation, you can say you're not doing it right. You're not talking about in a intimate relationship. You wouldn't say to your partner, you're not doing it right.
Probably
unless,
not.
Unless you want all of the psychological doors to shut in your face.
I probably would not.
Right.
I probably wouldn't even say it that way to a patient, although with some people
that's
I would.
That's what I'm sensing. Yeah, you wouldn't, because... One of the problems is that people come out of families where they've been helpless and the parents have been in charge. Mm-hmm. And that either can be a supportive, nurturing situation to some degree. I'm sure it's not always black and white. But in many cases, in many, 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 many cases, what we see is that that relationship was not a happy moment for the child. And the child has, in this very thing that you're talking about, limbic attractors and all that, has constructed a whole scenario that they replay over and over and over again in personal relationships. So you go into a therapist's office and they say, you're not doing it right, do it this way. You've just taken all of, you've just messed with that whole kind of underlying impossible thing to change. So how do you encourage someone to make the shift?
Well, what I would say, and I think Dr. Land and Dr. Meany would agree, is that there's no avoiding that thing in them. So trying to tiptoe your way around it will never work. And if you're going to engage it with them, that thing in them, whatever it is that's tender or doesn't work right, the sooner you engage it, the better. So say I say, well, you're not doing it right, and the person says, well, that's just what my mother used to say. Then I can say, all right, well, let's figure out how we can do it right. Because since I'm not exactly like your mother, maybe a little more helpful or whatever, here we are much later in life. You have many more skills. I'm a little bit more reasonable person. Even though I may be like your mother in some ways, let's figure out how the two of us can do it right this time. It may start off looking like the old thing, but let's see if we can direct it to a place that winds up in a new and better and different ending.
Well, my impression from reading the book is that when you start talking about limbic resonance and attractors and implicit and explicit memory, you're talking about the je ne sais quoi of what goes on inside of us, the fact that it isn't all on the surface and it isn't all perceivable. Mm-hmm. That there are things operating in a very kind of murky way. And part of what you say in the book is that a therapist walks out on a very thin limb and has to, in fact, stay present with their feelings, no matter what they are, when they're in a therapeutic situation. That a therapist is far less neutral than we experience them. If they're good therapists, we experience them as neutral. Do you see where I'm going?
Yes, and I think you're exactly right, that the kind of the older notion of therapeutic neutrality, that the therapist wouldn't feel much or wouldn't get tangled up in the patient's emotional kind of mishigas, is not accurate. And most people, regardless of what they say, don't do it that way. That, in fact, they do feel a lot emotionally in therapy, and they do get tangled up in the patient's emotional configuration, and that the solution to that problem is not to avoid getting tangled up in it. The solution is to get tangled up, and then you and the patient together try and figure out how do the two of us get out of this mess in a reasonable way that'll make you happier.
Isn't part of it also what you seem to be saying about love is that love changes, literally changes our pharmacology in our body, and you make a big case, and it was very lovely, for the fact that, you know, we've talked about how you can't be independent. You are going to be codependent. Codependent is a funny word. You're going to be interdependent mm-hmm. with people. There's going to be a dependency.
Sure.
But even more than that, you're going to very much change the brain and the physiology of your loved one, and they're going to change you. Together, you will be changed. But that means that a therapeutic relationship with a person who is wounded or damaged, either, you know, I guess I have to do a side thing here and say how they're wounded or damaged can be from behavioral things that were just noxious in childhood, but they can also come from families who were, where there's malnutrition. Some of the malnutrition is eating, addictive eating patterns that are based on foods with no nutrients. Dr. Stephen Schoenthaler, if you don't know his research, I should probably put you onto it, did a research project where he studied for 20 years students, children, violent offenders, all these people, and just did things like remove junk food first and then added vitamins. And the response that he saw, you know, in terms of food additives and things being removed, food allergies being removed, and adding in nutrient balance, was just astonishing. The IQ went up, the violent behavior went down, just on the basis of changing the pharmacy of the body with nutrients and removing offending substances. So there are many reasons why somebody becomes incapacitated in terms of their brain function and their capacity to resonate, as you say, limbically.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the behavioral stuff that's going on in a therapeutic office is that the therapist, if I understand correctly, is taking the place of the parent and the lover in re-imprinting and reteaching and fixing this sort of limbic attractor stuff. No?
That's very true.
Okay.
Yeah.
So why don't you talk about that?
I think that notion actually makes lots of therapists uncomfortable. And it's been raised theoretically a number of different times in different formulations. And some people have got kind of a bad rap in the past in some formulations. The idea wouldn't be that you play a role or you play act or you feign anything in order to fit within the patient's emotional needs, but that just as a regular person, you are affected by the kind of emotional radiation, if you will, that comes out of the patient and that affects the other people in their lives. You're affected by the moves that they make in relationships because they're having a relationship with you. And similarly, they're affected by your emotional vibes and by the moves that you make. And hopefully, if all goes well, they turn out to be a lot more affected by you than vice versa. That you can feel the pull toward old, unhelpful interactions, and you can go a little bit ways down that path as a therapist, and then you can stop yourself or stop the two of you and say, well, let's not do that. Let's do this other thing. It is an exceptionally difficult task.
Well, and you're talking about, essentially, I think what you seem to be making a case for is that we are trained on the subtlest levels you can think of, and that training changes us physiologically as children as we develop.
Absolutely. That
there's physiologic influences, but there are emotional influences, and it all forms who we are. And then it's the subtle package that's your wind-up toy, and you wind it up, and it does this thing. And to get this toy to wind up and behave differently, it has to be completely reconstructed. And it's very difficult to reconstruct a human brain once it's been on a track for a long time, as you say in the book. So part of the role, when you say therapy, is physiologic, then I have to think that what you're operating from is limbic resonance.
Definitely.
In the therapeutic relationship. Now, to me, that means that you have to be in touch with emotional issues and the patient has to be in touch. And there's a lot of surrendering going on, mostly, hopefully. What I'm trying to get to is people always do this thing of, well, can't you just do this with your friends? Why can't you just go and talk to your friends? And what I always say is, when things are really complex, you're not aware of what you're doing. You don't see how your sweater gets caught when you walk by the counter every time. You don't see that you're caught.
Mm-hmm.
And your friends may know that you're caught, but they may not have the skills to help you unravel what's going on. And if they try to do it, they're going to get into a very dicey situation with you because there are things like transference that occur in therapeutic relationships.
Definitely. And I think it's not theoretically impossible for somebody's friend or husband or wife to do it. It's just very, very difficult. For instance,
isn't it dangerous for a husband or wife or a friend to do it if it's really deep-seated stuff?
Well, I've certainly seen cases in which an understanding husband or wife can really help their partner through some difficult emotional waters.
Sure.
And one of the ways they usually do that is somewhat akin to a therapist in that they are affected by what goes on in the person emotionally, but they're not swept away by it. And say, as an example, somebody I was talking to earlier in the week, who one of her maneuvers in a relationship when she feels insecure and uncared for, she becomes antagonistic. And she's very good at antagonizing people. And one of the ways I can tell what's going on is in how annoyed I feel with her or how antagonized I feel. And then I can say to her, geez, whatever way I have to say it on that particular day, I can say, you know, I think you must be feeling insecure. You must be frightened, or there must be something going on in you that's hurt because I notice you're trying to antagonize me or annoy the hell out of me. If you were somebody's husband or wife, you might just get pissed off, or you might just reject them, or you might just say, oh, to heck with this. I've had enough of this. It's quite difficult to feel the pull of it and then not get swept away.
I'll say.
And that's the real art of therapy, is feeling the pull and then thinking, oh, maybe not that, and then coming back in
well,
a different
and,
direction.
Well, and I think also we are seeing more and more the resurgence of body-based or somatic-based therapy styles where there's less conversation going on and there's more reliance on what the body is trying to experience and feel and letting the feelings come out of the body physically, because people can talk a good turn and you can learn. Again, what you're doing is you're engaging the neocortex instead of engaging the limbic region. And the limbic region is the emotive, the more emotive part. So let me just read a passage from your book that talks about this. The first part of emotional healing is being limbically known, having someone with a keen ear catch your melodic essence. A child with emotionally hazy parents finds trying to know himself like wandering around in a museum in the dark. Almost anything could exist within its walls. He cannot ever be sure of what he senses. For adults, a precise seer's light can split the night, illuminate treasures long thought lost, and dissolve many fearsome figures into shadows and dust. Those who succeed in revealing themselves to another find the dimness receding from their own visions of self. Like people awakening from a dream, they slough off the accumulated, ill-fitting trappings of unsuitable lives. Then the mutual fund manager may become a sculptor, or vice versa. Some friendships lapse into dilapidated irreverence as new ones deepen. The city dweller moves to the country where he feels finally at home. As limbic clarity emerges, a life takes form. And so we change and we grow in an atmosphere of love. And a certain level of acceptance. And I think what we're saying here is that a good therapist can create a open space for that, and a friend, or a it gets more complicated because there's a bit give and take, but that there's no question that being loved helps. The problem is that there are so many people who can't be loved because they're so wounded. So something has to change. And in the changing, if they choose a therapeutic approach with a therapist, and there are many different ways to do it, the question then comes, should people be re-traumatized in therapy? And there's a big question about this. I did a show recently with someone who believes that there's a separate aspect to trauma. You know, if you get hit by a bus, there's physical trauma and that you can go through a physical experience. And when I engaged him in an interview, what I found was that I couldn't get him really to say that what he was doing was going to reshape the emotional framework of somebody who had been slowly and systematically destroyed as a child emotionally, mm-hmm. that's trauma. The question then comes, should you send a person back through family of origins experiences? Is there a benefit in re-traumatizing somebody and taking them back through a traumatic experience?
Do you mean recalling with them what happened?
Or connecting it back to family of origin rather than just in the present saying, okay, I just had an argument with my boss and it brought up these feelings and I'm feeling this way and boy, I'm really angry, and letting them be angry versus saying, who do we know that behaved like that? That why is this so important? You know, why do you care so much?
Well, I'll tell you what we think, and it may be a little unusual or controversial, which is that for the kind of process to take place that we're talking about, the relationship doesn't have to be about anything in particular. So in other words, we don't have to talk about the person's family of origin. It may be, say, in some of the cases you're talking about the nonverbal therapies, it may even be we don't have to talk at all, although I've never done a therapy that way. Peter Kramer, in one of his books, described a very lovely therapy in which he and an elder gentleman exclusively discussed gardening and plants. They didn't discuss anything other than gardening. I think it's illusory to think that we have to talk about this or that psychological issue. We may or we may not, but the technique of the therapy doesn't reside in the topic. The patient and I could be talking about gardening, and the same thing could happen between us emotionally that could happen if we were talking about their childhood, because they're still who they are. I'm still who I am. We're still resonating on that emotional channel. They're still affecting me. I'm still affecting them. And if they make a relationship move that throws me off balance, I can still say, if we're talking about gardening, geez, what's going on with that? Is that
Yeah, but how does that cause somebody to change these deep-seated things? I mean, then it really is just like having a friendship. Then it's like saying, well, anybody who accepts me as I am is going to make a profound difference in all of this, you know, all these things that you've been talking about that get us caught up, all of these constructs that are so deep-seated that it's very hard to move on as an adult and change.
It's not accepting the person as they are, because they have a little bit of them that must need to change. And it would be accepting a lot of them for who they are, but still pulling them or engaging them in that process of moving in a different direction. So I think it's true, say in that Peter Kramer example, that through a discussion of gardening, he could feel the underlying emotional tones that the guy was expressing, say sadness or grief or some desire to nurture something in his talk of gardening, and that the two of them could have an emotional experience even though the ostensible topic is very unemotional.
How does that change the patient?
Because the emotional force fields are still being transmitted. And again, that gets into that distinction between the cortical brain, where it really matters what the topic is, if it's physics or gardening or emotions, and the limbic brain, where those emotional forces are still emanating and being felt throughout the whole interaction, regardless of what it is we're nominally speaking about.
And you're saying that that kind of reorients things in terms of people's capacity for limbic resonance and capacity to love?
Absolutely. And okay. In fact, I think there's this entire world of forces that operates just beneath our awareness in terms of how strongly someone's emotional kind of being can be felt by the parts of your brain that apprehend those signals and vice versa. And we have so much cortical overlayering in terms of thinking and reason and logic and conversation that we miss a lot of that. But it still goes on nonetheless. It's like a little wireless channel that operates between you and somebody else. And you can feel it sometimes when you're not speaking to somebody. You can feel that connection. Just like, you know, if you come home after a long day, you can tell whether something's bothering your wife or not, or mm-hmm. your husband or not. You don't know how to know it, but you know there's something wrong with the person. There's an emotional emanation that your brain can sense. And the same thing is true in therapy. And I certainly have conducted therapies in which the person said at the outset, what happened to me as a child was awful, I don't want to talk about it, and I'm not going to discuss anything that happened to me prior to age 18. I said, well, okay.
You know, another problem here is that, I mean, that's interesting because it means there are a lot of different ways to get through. When people are very, very wounded, when they're really hurting in various ways, or they're really cut off, they're extremely cut off, they're not well equipped to choose a therapist because they don't know how to choose relationships, and they're choosing relationships, for lack of a better word, neurotically.
Right.
And not all therapists are good therapists or even evolved human beings. So, and not all therapists let people go. You get very attached. And any suggestions for the consumer out there?
That's very true. Those are very hard questions.
I see it happen all the time.
Very hard. I think one of the questions that I hear most often is whether something is supposed to happen, that the person has been in therapy for X number of months or years and they don't feel anything happening. Is something, are they supposed to feel something different? And the answer is yes.
Yes.
That therapy is like an artistic experience in that you're supposed to feel something. You may not understand it, and you may not understand how or why it moves you, but you should feel a force operating in the environment.
At the end of your book, you make a really impassioned political and cultural plea for a loving society. You talk a lot about child care and keeping babies in the bed and things like that. What are we going to do about the fact that the biggest part of our society, the most wounded, largest population, are people impoverished who can never begin to afford a therapist who's had very expensive training, you know? What are we going to do about, you know, and they're also living in poverty and the nutrients are just completely nuts and everything's all, what are we going to do?
Well, there's when there's poverty that exists such that people don't get, say, the basic essential nutrients, like they don't get enough protein to build a healthy brain, say, or they don't get enough carbohydrate. That clearly is not a problem that psychotherapy can solve.
No, but I'm talking about the aspect of we've got wounded individuals. What are we going to do? I mean, the most wounded individuals, the people who are suffering the most, are people in poverty because their families are, you know.
Well, one of the interesting things is you don't need much in the way of material possession in order to make relationships work. Mostly what you need is togetherness and some time.
And that does exist in poor families.
It does exist in poor families, and not infrequently. Some of those families are very resilient emotionally. They tend to have strong kind of family and cultural and community ties that bind them together and can be very healthy and strength-promoting for people emotionally. So the outlook emotionally for the poorer classes is perhaps not as bad as one might think. For the upper classes, I think it's looking worse and worse.
Yeah, it is. I have a last question, and we don't have much time left, so I apologize for springing it on at the end. I'm wondering what effect being a therapist has for you on your primary relationship.
Well, that's a fascinating question. I think being a therapist has opened my eyes to many things I never would have believed existed, and it has opened my eyes to the myriad of variety that are in other people. Unless someone had forced me to do it, to sit in a room and get to know people, I never would have believed that people are as different from one another as they actually are. And I think most people don't realize that. At least maybe they're more perceptive than I was, but a lot of people don't realize just how different other people are from anybody else.
No, they wouldn't be so angry at everybody if they realized how different, I think. So you're saying it opened you up.
Tremendously.
Yeah.
So that I don't expect anymore that people will think the way I do or agree with me. And if my wife doesn't agree with me, I don't think it's an abnormality to be corrected. Maybe she's right. It makes me curious about
it. That's wonderful. That's fabulous. So it's really good training. Thank you so much for coming in person. How nice.
It was
so nice
pleasure.
To have a live interview. Again, the name of the book is A General Theory of Love. We've been talking to Thomas Lewis, M.D., a psychiatrist in private practice in Marin or in San Francisco?
San Francisco,
but he's opted not to give out his phone number. The book is available from Vintage Books, and again, it is A General Theory of Love. Thomas Lewis, M.D., Ferry Ami, and Richard Lennon, all M.D.s. Thank you very much for your book and for coming in.
Oh, thank you.
And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information and or you want a CD copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-2772. You can also go to the website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, to listen to the show online all week. For a list of other available shows, information about guests, and news about the nonprofit and the benefits of membership, again, go to the website, yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is a joint production of Your Own Health and Fitness and KPFA-FM. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.